You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. What is technology doing to us? How does it affect our ability to work, to be present, to connect to one another? Podcaster Aliyah Tavakolian wonders about these things all the time, and tech journalist Bob Sullivan has spent his life finding the answers. Their new podcast, So Bob, is your opportunity to ask, So Bob, how can I live a better digital life? Follow So Bob on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And now, on with the show.
I want to meet the people risking everything.
You don't have the camera? It's like high school all over again.
And see just how far they will go for their cause.
What can people like me do to help out a situation like this?
Listen.
Say that again?
Listen.
Okay.
Maybe this is where I belong.
I've been told I have a face for radio.
You do.
With people willing to risk everything.
Let's go. You guys are under arrest.
We're getting arrested.
Education, not segregation!
Is there any way to stand beside you, but courageously sit down a little bit in the back?
No.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a preview of Comedy Central's new docuseries, Klepper, which airs Thursdays at 10:30 Eastern. In his new show, Jordan Klepper, former Daily Show correspondent and host of Comedy Central's late-night show The Opposition, is leaving the comfort of the studio to embed on the front lines of America's push for change and ride shotgun with America's resistors, contrarians, and dreamers. Klepper explores America's most pressing issues, from veteran deportations and discrimination in the burgeoning marijuana industry to the contemporary space exploration landscape and gun-toting guerrilla activists. And today, Jordan Klepper returns to the podcast to talk about the end of his late-night show, The Opposition, and what it's like to get out from behind the desk and get uncomfortable out in the real world again. He tells the story of a wrestling club in Texas that's helping veterans body slam their way through PTSD, what it says about how vets get treated by the VA and by their fellow Americans, and what it was like when Jordan got in the ring with them himself and promptly got his butt kicked. Then Jordan recalls sleeping in the swamp for two nights and capsizing his boat in the middle of the Louisiana Bayou as part of a direct action protest against an oil pipeline. He explains how the state of Georgia is making life difficult for children of undocumented workers who just want an education, how they're looking to the civil rights movement of the 60s for inspiration, and even forming their own university. Plus, Jordan opens up about the incident that got him arrested and his memorable stay in the Fulton County Jail. Coming up with Jordan Klepper in just a moment. Today I'm happy to welcome back to the show the kid from Kalamazoo, Jordan Klepper. You know Jordan from his memorable appearances as a former correspondent on The Daily Show, for his one-hour investigative comedy special, Jordan Klepper Solves Guns, and more recently as the host of The Opposition with Jordan Klepper. Now he's traveling the country to explore our most pressing issues and talk to the people on the front lines fighting for change in his new series, Klepper, which airs Thursdays on Comedy Central. Jordan, welcome back to the podcast.
Ben, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Well, your previous show on Comedy Central was a more traditional late-night talk show that lasted about a year. And in your new series, Klepper, you seem to make a lot of semi-self-deprecating jokes about not being behind a desk anymore and getting outside of the studio. You seem to have a pretty good sense of humor about it at this point. How do you look back on that experience now?
Well, I mean, I think I better have a good sense of humor about all of that. I mean, I look back, I love my time at The Opposition. That was one of the most rewarding jobs I've had with a great cast of folks and a show I was really proud of. And it was really fun to be behind a desk to craft a show in a daily show type format, in that it's day in, day out. You're in front of an audience at 6:30 every night, rain or shine. It left me missing getting out into America and spending time with people, telling those stories, being on the road. I then go on the road. I then enjoy being on the road. But then I also realize that being on the road is a little more difficult and a lot less comfortable than, say, being behind a desk. So those moments of levity where I look at the camera and perhaps grumpily say I used to be behind the desk, there's some pathos in that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's a lot more work if you're traveling and, of course, all the pre-production that must go into a show like Klepper.
It's a totally different beast. Like we approach it, and the pre-production is all about research. It's about following up on stories, finding characters, finding angles, finding ways in which we can approach a story. And then a big part of this entire season and this entire show was to go to a place where something is happening. So it's not just people retelling a story. It's me there, a part of that story. And it takes a lot to find the right people and the right stories that we can speak to. And then you spend all your time out on the road, approaching it much more like making a documentary than a traditional field piece. So it was much more immersive. I was out and about for the last 6 months. My wife complained about that a decent amount. I never around at home, but she knew I was doing it for the betterment of society. So, or at least that's what I told her. And I hope other people will concur. Ben, concur, please.
Yeah, and this is definitely in line with what most of your career has been spent on as a correspondent for The Daily Show or your Comedy Central special, Jordan Klepper Solves Guns. Do you feel more comfortable being out in the real world?
You know, the real world, I've spent most of my life in the real world. I would argue, you know, up until the last election, most of life existed in the real world. So it's your reality is an interesting thing to look at in this day and age. I do feel comfortable on the road and comfortable talking to people, grabbing a beer in a bar, hearing the stories face to face. The studio is a really fun place, and I've always enjoyed that with The Daily Show, and I enjoy doing it so much with The Opposition. But there is something you get by actually going there. I was very fortunate to get to do a show day in and day out. But you are in New York, and you're in an air-conditioned studio, and you're talking a lot about what's happening elsewhere, and you're reading those stories, you're developing opinions on them. It is a shift to go out there and hear it from somebody who is actually living that story, who will actually take you to where they are trying to enact change. And I think, like, just as a person, I've always gotten so much more out of that.
And I know from our last conversation that you come from an improv background. Does that come in handy when you're out there in the field talking to people you've never met who might say who knows what and who knows where the day may take you?
Yeah, I think as far as improv goes, a big thing you learn is to continue to build and also to listen. And that's the number one thing on the road is you go out there and you listen to the stories that they want to tell. I think we have the luxury of going out and spending, you know, days with people and characters, and you go out with an assumption as to what their story is. You've had interviews with them, pre-interviews. You've researched the characters you're going to talk to, the stories you're going to deal with. But when you go out there, you have to sit down and be open to the story that emerges and the story that you tell. Improv gives you that flexibility, that ability to pay attention, and also like to continue to craft. I think what was so fascinating about something like this, and when you're making something that feels like a documentary series as opposed to just a field piece, you are essentially creating all of the found footage. You're going out there, you're talking to people, you're trying to gather as much of the story as you can, bringing it back, and then piecing together what an honest comedic reflection of the thing you saw is. And so improv is there in the collection phase. Mm-hmm. Go out, talk, find stories, get people talking about what they're passionate about, and be a part of that and be ready to adapt. And the things we're most proud of with this entire series are the moments of adaptation and unexpectedness, because I feel like that's the that's why you turn on TV, is to go somewhere else and see something that you didn't expect. And I think we found that a few times in this series.
And speaking of adaptation and flexibility, I wonder, are there situations where you went in with a particular opinion on an issue and maybe it changed or became more nuanced as you got deeper into it with the people on the ground?
I'd like to think all of the episodes had an element of that. Mm-hmm. We did, an episode on pipeline protesters, and you go in and you're empathizing with the environmentalists who are trying to stop the oil pipeline in town. And I do empathize with that. I feel like there needs to be drastic action to combat some of the negative effects that we're imposing on our own environment. But you would then also go into the bars in town and talk to the people who work in the industry, and you see how oil is connected to a community in a way that you can't completely disregard. And so I think like a goal of this series was to find that gray area, stick with that person beyond just that first assumption that you have with them, whether they're an open carry proponent, like spend some more time with them, whether they're a vet that you have a hard time connecting to, like go to their stand-up comedy show. Understand that, like, oh, we're all struggling to try to reach an audience. They're more than just the stars that you see on their uniform.
Yeah, and you just mentioned that second episode in which you camp out in the bayou with a direct action group that's protesting a major oil pipeline through Louisiana. I don't want to make any judgments about you, Jordan, but you don't seem like a guy who would be particularly at home living out of a tent in the swamp for two nights.
That sounds like a judgment. That does sound like a judgment.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay, it's an assumption.
I'm definitely not that person. I think that was sort of, you know, people ask where we find humor in situations like this, because these are serious topics, and there's people who are putting everything on the line to try to enact some sort of change. And I think the humor does come with somebody like me who would like to be out there, but out there is hard. Wherever there is, out there has mosquitoes, out there has tents that you have to put up, out there has boats that you have to figure out how to paddle and then swim when you capsize it. And so, yeah, I was not at home camping out and then waking up at 2 a.m. to do a direct action. But I think those who are deserve credit because they're putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, and the company behind this pipeline, Energy Transfer, has a pretty deplorable record of safety. Can you tell us a little about them?
Well, I think I don't have the stat in front of me, but it's almost like a spill is averaged almost every 11 days with Energy Transfer partners. Mm-hmm. And so what we were so compelled with by the pipeline story, we knew the Dakota Access Pipeline and made such news in the last year and a half, but the extension of that has gone down into the bayou, and you have these protesters who are trying to continue to draw attention to it to try to slow that down. That episode is heartbreaking because you see the effects of the oil industry in Louisiana, in the bayou. Not only does it affect the environmental habitat, and we talked to someone who is in the Atchafalaya Basin, who tries to keep it safe and healthy for the wildlife and also for the floodplain, because once you start to mess with that and mess all that up, you can, if something happens within the climate, which has been known to happen, you can lose so much land. And then we also went down to a place that is sadly known as Cancer Alley. And because of the preponderance of the oil industry down there, you have a lot of people who have come down with mysterious ailments because of the air quality, and they're trying to speak out. But it's a big business down there in Louisiana, and there's a lot of money, and a lot of that money goes right up to the state. And I think like wherever you can give voice to the people who are just trying to be healthy, who are just trying to protect the place they grew up to, I think you have to look to give that voice.
Yeah, these protesters are kind of brave taking on a company like Energy Transfer because they are right there in the heart of oil country, and energy companies probably employ a lot of people down there in Louisiana. I have to imagine that there were probably some people who weren't too happy to have them down there and maybe looked at them as some kind of carpetbaggers. Did they encounter a lot of pushback from the locals?
That there was a lot of discussion about specifically that issue. Is you had people who were from the area, and the main protesters who were there, who were the pipeline protesters, were indigenous women who were from the area and pushing back because this was land they had a connection to. But you also had a lot of people who were coming from other states who were there to protest in general. And I think the community had a frustration with that. They did feel like there are people coming in. This is not their backyard. But then you would put that question to the protesters, and their response is just like, this is everybody's issue. And if it is injustice, if it is infecting the earth and it is infecting other people, you have to fight for this if you have the opportunity. And I think that tension exists in a lot of places around this country of like, you know, these things affect more than just the people in their communities. And at what point do you take action and you support people who you feel are being wronged who are not in your backyard? And I think we saw that play out.
Now, in episode one, you go to Killeen, Texas to talk to a group of veterans who put on wrestling shows as the Valhalla Club. And these guys, they go all out, like pro wrestlers with costumes and characters and the whole deal. What do they get out of that?
Well, they're dealing with PTSD, and I think what we, Killeen, Texas, there's many veterans. Fort Hood is down there in Texas, and you have a lot of veterans who are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. And some people go the traditional VA route. Some people, you know, seek help in pills, and some works for some. Some doesn't work for others. And this group has found that the community they find in professional wrestling, and also the act of playing a character, building yourself up, all of this is an escape for them. And so we threw ourselves right into it to watch it up close, and it was. I mean, it was inspiring to see. I think we went to a couple different matches, and I was a part of one. I got less out of it, I will say, other than bruises and almost a broken foot. But when you go there, what you do see is you see a community that comes to see them, to support. It's cathartic to cheer on the good guy, to boo the bad guy. It's fun to see these guys, you know, owning an arena and a space in a way that they can be applauded for this like creative endeavor that they've done. You also see a lot of veterans who show up at these events, and they're wearing hats that are emblazing the service that they were in, or shirts or other signifiers. And these guys in the Valhalla Club, after the match, before the match, will come up and they'll engage in conversations. And you see just this connection. That when I talk to these guys, that's the thing they miss. Like, if, you know, the guys from the Valhalla Club served in Iraq, and they talk about the community they had over there and the ability to connect with other people who had been through things that that people back home can't relate to. And it's an odd place to see it happen, but in the middle of Texas, in a professional wrestling ring, to see veterans come together and be able to be like, hey, I like what you do. Can we talk for a few minutes? Like, those things you see being used beyond just community, but as a way to provide therapy for these guys. And you know, we were lucky to be a part of it.
One thing that I found really interesting and touching is a lot of them described wrestling as a way to, quote, this is using their words, rewrite their story and play a bigger and more heroic character. That surprised me, that men who had risked their life in Iraq felt the need to don a mask and pretend to be someone else in order to feel heroic. Does that say something about how we treat our vets?
I think it does. I think there is a disconnect a lot of civilians have with the veteran community. I know I have it. It's something that feels like such an alien experience in many ways, that civilians often say thank you for your service as a way to connect and then leave it at that. And when I would talk to a lot of the veterans there, they talk about that as an empty gesture and just want kind of that human connection. And so you see these vets finding these unique different ways in which to feel empowered and to feel oddly less alien, if you will. And it does sound silly and ridiculous that it's like, oh, these guys, you're putting on face makeup, you're wearing spandex, and you're getting into a ring, and that is what gives you some humanity and the ability to feel like a hero there. But it's also something that you see, like, their family coming to and seeing them excel at. Like, a thing that shows both athletic prowess and physical achievement without being inherently violent. Like, it's things that are palpable to an audience and to family members who might not have been able to understand their experiences in Iraq, but they can see them be a hero there in Texas.
And yeah, I think in the beginning of that episode, you admit that you have trouble with saying thank you for your service, or just the awkwardness of it, of the empty gesture. When you talk to vets, do they feel that it's kind of a bullshit gesture? And what would they like people to do in place of that? What would have more meaning for them?
You know, I think a lot of the vets that I've talked to, I think, understand where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And it might be extreme for me to say that they feel that it's bullshit, but I think they feel that it feels empty at times. And they know it comes mostly out of people's either nervousness or just a general sense of respect. I talked to Bryson down there with the Valhalla Club, and I think some of the things they talk about is like, you can thank me for my service. Yeah. What I really need right now is a job. Do you know ways in which you can help a veteran by giving them access to employment? do you want to just talk to me beyond the weird wall we put up because of the service that I did and just connect with me for a few minutes? Like all human beings, they want connection. They want opportunity. And sometimes thank you for your service can be like, it almost lets us civilians off too easy. Like it's a good thing to do. We should respect our vets. But sure. Beyond thanking them for their service, can you take that extra step and connect with them about something beyond their service? I think that's the first step.
Yeah, I can't remember where I heard this, but somewhere along the way, I was talking to a guest who probably, I think, did a documentary on vets. And one of the vets said something along the lines of, instead of thanking me for my service, ask me about my story. Because as you mentioned a moment ago, one of the biggest problems is that there's this weird disconnect. And I suppose that's probably what comes from America having sort of a military class that's separate from the rest of society.
I think it definitely is. And there's experiences a lot of these soldiers had over there that are hard to bring back to civilians who can't connect to it.
Sure.
Also, there's a politicization. Boy, that's a tough word. We politicize our military. At least it feels that way. When I talk to these vets, though, you know, the idea of Democrat or Republican didn't come up. You know, they don't want to engage with comments most of the time with discussing the executive branch or what have you. They're over there to do a job, and their job is to protect the people around them and to serve for this country. And so I think it's often civilians who bring a political element to it or see it as something that could be dicey because of that. And I think that gets in the way of what's actually happening there. It's like connect with these people about so many other things that's not the baggage you bring to it.
Mm-hmm. What were the biggest complaints they had about the VA?
Everybody had a different story with the VA. Most of it was the red tape. I think there's, you know, some veterans have had great experiences. Many of them had problems with the ability to get in to see doctors, the wait time. Some felt like it was overworked in a way that, like, some of their issues, whether it was PTSD or other issues they were having, were dealt with in a quick blanket way that's not kind of taking in the entire individual there. I think it's too easy. I think if we were doing a traditional piece, if you will, where it was like, we have 4 minutes, we're going to go talk about it, you look at the VA and on paper, you're like, oh, they're probably the bad guy. That's the guy getting in the way. And it's not true. It's more complicated than that. Like, mm-hmm. What the VA doesn't have in many ways is like the facilities and the resources they need to deal with so many people who are coming back from wars and some who are not even seeing active combat, who are having issues with post-traumatic stress disorder and need things beyond just a pill or a quick fix. There is no quick fix. And yeah. So, you know, I think like the VA in many cases is doing what it can do. I think the issue many of these guys had with it is just like, we need something more. Can it be provided through the VA? Maybe. Can it be provided by other things that we have to find outside of it? Maybe as well. That's putting an extra burden, though, on the people coming back home.
And when you actually got in the ring with them, wasn't your wrestling character this villain called, like, Mr. Red Tape or something like that?
I was. I wanted to create a character that I could let these vets body slam and win out over. And the thing that seemed to get in the way of them getting help was this idea of red tape. Whether that's at the VA or elsewhere, it's bureaucracy that seems to get in the way from us helping vets too often. And so I embodied that with a weird outfit and poor posture, and I let them slam me through a table.
And in one scene, I think that you whack them over the head or something with a pool cue, and I want to say there was also a folding chair. I always wonder this. How do they do that without hurting someone? Or themselves.
This is what's amazing to me. It's like I did the folding chair thing, and they taught me how to hit them with a folding chair. But that process is basically take this folding chair and hit me with it. Try to
really?
Hit me flat, but hit me with it. Like so much of the wrestling world is these things actually happen. When I got slammed through a table, I went through a table.
Really?
When I hit him with a chair, it was a chair. It wasn't a magic chair. In my head, I was like, this must be some magic styrofoam chair with a bunch of actors. It's like, no. These are guys getting hit with chairs. I hit Eddie with a kendo stick, which is a big stick, and I whacked him with it. It makes a big noise. It does hurt. And in that one, we cut some of this out of the final episode, but I hit him with a kendo stick and he immediately falls down and he comes up with a giant cut on his head and he starts bleeding. And in the moment, I'm like, I know what you guys are doing. You're trying to make me feel bad. It's a joke. Ha, 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 ha. And he shows me the cut and there's actually a big gash on its head and it's bleeding. It keeps bleeding. I'm like, I get it. You cut yourself. Wow. Ha, ha, ha. they kept this up for 10 minutes. And I'm starting to feel terrible about this. Eventually, I'm like, wait, did I really hurt you? I didn't even think I hit you there. It becomes this whole guilt moment. And then he reveals, like, no, no, I cut myself. When you hit me, I rolled over and I took out a razor blade. I sliced my head, and so I bled all over the place.
Oh, my God.
We were playing a joke on you.
Wow.
I'm like, that was the joke they played on me. He sliced his head open, and throughout the episode, you see this big cut on his head. I was like, this is supposed to be fake. They're like, well, yeah. I mean, you didn't hit me with the stick. Instead, I cut myself with a razor blade. So these guys go all out.
Wow, yeah. I mean, who would think that some vets in Killeen, Texas would teach you something about dedication to a character?
I know. Where were they a year ago, for God's sakes? I could have used that. Early stages of the opposition. It's like, what do I need to do to stay in character? Wow, okay. Will I bleed for this character? I don't know.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Jordan Klepper when we come back in just a minute. If you don't know SiriusXM, then listen up. SiriusXM brings the deepest variety of commercial-free music for every genre and for every mood, where you hear the biggest names in talk, entertainment, and comedy, where you get news from every source. Now, I know what you're thinking. Don't you need a car to enjoy SiriusXM? A lot of people think that, but you don't. You can listen outside of the car. And right now, you can get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for just $1. Just go to SiriusXM/kick to see offer details and to subscribe. For $1, you can listen to SiriusXM on your phone, at home, and online. So anywhere you are, any time of day, you can hear your favorite songs or discover new ones. Go to Sirius, SiriusXM.com/kick. And get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for $1. See offer details. Offer available to new SiriusXM streaming subscribers. SiriusXM. No car required. And now, back to the show. And you also talked to a veteran who was a combat medic in Iraq, and now he's doing stand-up. How does he find humor in talking about all these serious and traumatizing events he experienced?
I mean, he talks about, his name is Eddie, and he's fascinating, a man of many talents. He talks about, like, it being cathartic for him. I think he likes the rush of getting out there. But he loves, like, I went and watched him. He loves walking on out there and addressing the elephant in the room. And he's a big, tough guy. He looks like a vet. He's ripped as all get out. He's wearing Wounded Warriors polo. So, like, you see him, and he calls it out right off the bat about, like, I know what you think I am. I know all the assumptions you have. And I think the purpose of comedy in a position like that is, how do you subvert all of those expectations? And so I think it was really potent to watch a vet up there doing stand-up, because it is just that. You walk on stage, and you're going to see a bunch of comics who all have similar experiences that I have of, like, I'm going to talk about airline food or some of the frustrations I had about logging onto Starbucks Wi-Fi, and then up walks a vet who's huge, who's a combat medic, who's going to talk about what it's like to shit himself in Iraq because a bomb had gone off nearby. And immediately it's compelling. Now the challenge is, how do you take that reality, put an audience at ease, and also kind of humanize yourself? But it's a great way, though, for, again, to break down that barrier between citizen and vet. And I think comedy is such a nice way to do it.
Now, I have to mention episode 3. That's an interesting one that kind of made some headlines. You visit Georgia, where undocumented immigrants and, I think, DACA kids aren't allowed to attend state colleges. What was the Georgia Board of Regents' reasoning for banning them from college?
Well, Georgia has some of the strictest anti-immigration laws in the nation, and I think, like, they've as we may know, based on some of the more fun campaign videos of the last campaign, Governor Kemp just came in, whose very famous campaign video was literally him in a truck talking about how he wants to drive around and pick up immigrants. And so I think, like, that's sort of the the general timber of the state when it comes to people who are there, who are undocumented or who are DACA students. And so you have a very conservative Board of Regents who are not voted in, but they are put there by the governor, and they are hardline. And so unlike most other states, they deny to a couple of the major major colleges and universities in Georgia, they deny access to undocumented DACA students. And it's really heartbreaking to see. But in that heartbreak is also inspiration. There's a thing called Freedom University that has built out of what happened during the civil rights, Freedom Universities back in the 60s. It's an underground university that teaches these students who can't go to these local universities. It gets them college ready. It looks for other college opportunities, and it teaches them on the weekends. And they come from all over because they want to learn and they want to succeed. And so I was lucky enough to get to spend some time with them. And you want to stand up for students like this who don't have a voice, who want to give back to our culture, and you have a culture that's treating them like second-class citizens. It's treating them like people who don't pay taxes and who don't want to better this country. And I think you spend a few days with these students, and these are the best of the students in our country, and we should give them the opportunity to have that education. And the Board of Regents meeting was one that I attended, and along with other faith leaders and teachers at the school, I stood up with them. And when you stand up with folks like that in Atlanta, they lock you up and throw away the key. Or they found the key, but it took about 12 hours later to find it.
Yeah, you made a lot of headlines with this episode because you actually did get arrested. Talk a little more about the event that led to that.
Well, it was the Board of Regents meeting, and again, there were local faith leaders who showed up, who wanted to give voice to the students, along with teachers from Freedom University who also showed up. And during the Board of Regents meeting, there was a prayer to start the meeting, and one of the faith leaders stood up and continued that prayer and asked people to look out for those who want an education, who are undocumented. We should protect them as well. Education, not segregation, was the theme of the prayers. And one by one, each of the faith leaders and the teachers stood up, continued the prayer. I stood up, and as I'm not a man of God, but I'm a man of Viacom, and so I stood up, and I didn't reach towards God, but I reached towards a common human empathy. And at that moment, they pushed me out along with the other pastors and teachers, and we continued there in the governmental building, continuing the prayer, making a statement, and with that, they handcuffed us all and took us off to the county jail.
Yeah, and I kind of felt sorry for, I don't know what he was, a deputy or whatever who was there, and because he said to you, he said, look, I get it. I actually sympathize with your cause, but I got to do my job.
100%. I mean, the police officers who took care of us there said just that. They made it very clear, these are the lines. If you step over these lines, we will arrest you, and this is what we have to do.
Yeah.
They treated me fairly and kindly throughout the whole process, and even when I was in jail, like the people at the jail who had kind of heard what I had done and what some of the pastors had done, like, They spoke with reverence and respect for those actions. Like, they all had a job to do, and we weren't there to upset those folks. We were there to draw attention to the people who actually had power in that room.
Yeah.
But that is a town that is Atlanta's a town with a lot of history, and a lot of people, a lot of faith leaders have stood up over the decades to draw attention to these things. And so when even you might not get love in that room from the Board of Regents folks, but you do with the other members in the community who want people to stand up for what's right and what's just.
As one of the epicenters of the civil rights movement in the 60s, do they see parallels between the Black civil rights movement and school integration way back then and the struggles of undocumented immigrants today?
They do, and I think that's part of what actually inspired me. Part of the classes, the things that they teach are history, looking at the history of the civil rights movement, of direct actions. They brought in Charles Black, who was a student of Martin Luther King's back in the day, and he came and he talks to the students, reading speeches, literature, MLK books. Like, these students were very aware, and when I talked to their teacher, Dr. Emiko, about this, you know, some people from the right don't like these ideas. They're like, are you trying to create protesters and activists out of these students? And she's like, you know, we teach all subjects, but we do teach the civil rights movement, and we do teach the importance of protest, because for students like this, we don't see this as a luxury. This is a necessity. This is how they get their voice heard. And I was down there, and I marched with them on the Martin Luther King Jr. birthday, which is an amazing event in Atlanta. And you go to Ebenezer Church, and you talk to people. And the civil rights movement is still very alive down there, and you see how it has affected that community. And even talking to the other faith members in that community, it was really moving for me. I mean, I joked about it earlier. I'm not religious, but seeing what these faith leaders do, their role in the community goes beyond just providing religious support to a community. They see themselves as a voice and as a beacon and as a community that has to consistently push back against people who are trying to silence other people. And so I was incredibly moved by that history, and it felt very present today with the students at Freedom University.
On a side note, in that episode, you actually call out Georgia because at one point, I guess they suspended immigration enforcement during the Atlanta Olympics, right?
Yeah, it's an insane detail. Like they needed, as we may remember back in the day when Atlanta held the Olympics there, you know, they were behind schedule, so they relaxed immigration laws to get more undocumented people to come into Atlanta to help build up the Olympics, to show off the great city of Atlanta. And you had an influx of people to come and to work. A lot of the students that even come to Freedom University, many of them, their parents came over around that time to try to make this a better place. And I think that's like a history. This is what our country does. It's like we rely on people from other countries to come on in to make our lives easier, better, our cities more beautiful, more ready for the world to see. And then we push them in the corner. And I think like it's shameful. Mm-hmm. And so we keep doing it over and over and over again. And we delegitimize the experience of so many people who helped build this country. Like it's what we do as Americans. We need to stop doing it. And we need to learn from some of this history. And I think like you see that then and there. You see like part of the episode, I'm walking around these Atlanta grounds that were built up based on undocumented people who had come here trying to make that a beautiful city. And it's something we should be learning from.
Yeah. At one point, you talked to an anti-immigration activist, and what he keeps saying is that he just wants to make life as hard as possible on undocumented immigrants and just make them miserable in hopes that, I guess, they'll give up and go away.
It feels like a lot of the anger that comes from the right pushes back and tries to make every little step that much harder for people, which also to me comes as like this this hypocritical action as well, because even the far right will push this idea of assimilation, and you have people who are like, if what you really want is this very loaded term of assimilation, if you want people to come over and be a part of our culture, like, you know, we didn't even have time to look fully in this episode, but in talking to him about he was very much a proponent of like English first and these types of programs that really push like, I want people to come into America and learn our ways. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you have these students whose entire goal is to like be educated, be productive. They're already taxpayers. And I think like if you can accept that as what they're trying to do and still trying to make it more difficult, then it goes beyond any kind of puritanical view of what America is. And it just then leans over into racism and xenophobia. And I think when I talk to these students, a thing that kept resonating, like I remember being 18 and wanting to go to college. Almost all of these students wanted to do some sort of social work. They wanted to be teachers. One student wanted to go to college because they wanted to be a bilingual nurse practitioner in the community because they see members of their community and their parents who have a hard time speaking English, and then they go to hospitals and then they can't communicate the issues that they have. Like, these are people who want to give back to the community. They want to help. They're not trying to go to college to become Wall Street bigwigs or ad execs or dumb Comedy Central hosts. They're going to college to try to give back to their own community. And I think like it's just infuriating that we are trying to stop people from doing that. It's like, look around. We have kids who want to learn. They want to give back. Those are the people we should be fast tracking to learn so they can give back, because we need it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I have to ask, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I do have to ask, Jordan, how was jail? Did you have any experiences that we might recognize from Oz or Shawshank?
I did. I'll say right off the bat, you walk in there and there's a strip search and there's a cough to see if anything falls out of your butt. It happens like immediately. I think like you walk into a room and they line you up, and it's me and a bunch of pastors. They take us one by one into a room. They leave the door ajar so nothing funny happens. And then you're hearing coughs and clothes being taken off. Like I was like, oh wow, I guess I kind of thought this was this was something that is maybe embellished for television. It's like, nope, that's the case.
Yeah. Can I correctly assume that nothing came out?
You can correctly assume. Okay. I passed the two cough threshold, yeah, and my anus was clear.
Well, in a related episode, which I have not seen yet, but I understand that you also do an episode on military vets who've gotten deported. You know, yes. I have to think, what happened to We Support Our Troops? Personally, I don't even understand how that's possible.
It's a wild story. I mean, we look at, there are veterans who serve this country. And as you know, if you serve this country, it is basically set up where you get to become a citizen of this country.
Yeah.
But you have many people who assumed they automatically became citizens, but the paperwork didn't go through. They didn't officially become citizens after their time, and then they found themselves on the other side of the law at one point, serving their time. Some of these people had petty offenses. Some of these people, like a check bounce, and they go to jail. And then they come on out and they get deported. And it's shocking. There are people who like put their lives on the line to fight for this country, and now they're gone and they can't find a way back into this country. And so it was a really jaw-dropping story that we read about. It was, as we pitched stories, it literally was pitched. It gave the title of the story, and usually we say, like, write a little bit about what we could talk about in this episode or why it's important, and literally all we wrote was deported fucking vets. I was like, yeah, I think that's the story right there. And we went around the country and we followed somebody who was trying to bring attention to this, because not a lot of people know about this. We went to Tijuana and talked to veterans who are in a place called The Bunker, which is where the veterans basically gather to try to find community again and try to find ways in which they can talk to their families, and if there's any kind of way in which to reach out to. There are some Congress folks who are sympathetic to this cause. Tammy Duckworth is one. They keep trying to bring it up. Elizabeth Warren has spoken a little bit about this, but it's a dicey topic, because it's dealing with immigration. It's dealing with vets, which it seems as if Americans are all 100% behind. It's also dealing with the criminal justice system. And so if you've committed a crime and you've done your time, usually you can get back on with your life, but it makes it a less politically advantageous or politically clear issue for a lot of people. And so it kind of just gets swept under the rug. Yeah. So we tried to talk to some of those vets and bring some light to it.
Well, let me ask you this, Jordan. Having embedded with people who have actual skin in the game, who are true activists protesting and in some cases risking their freedom for what they believe in, do you think there's a lesson here for a society that's full of righteous indignation on Twitter and eager to virtue signal on their Facebook, but maybe a little more reticent when it comes to actually getting off the couch and showing up when it matters?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that with making this show, and I'm right along with them. I think the time to stand up and make your voice heard is now on all sides. I think you see a country of people who are frustrated with the way America is going, mm-hmm, on the left and the right. But you see a lot of people taking action through their phone. And sometimes that can be a positive thing. Sometimes you can gather positive support. You can raise money for just issues. What was really inspiring about this was seeing people who actually get up off their ass and do something about it. And it's hard. Change is really hard, and it's uncomfortable, and it doesn't always go as you want it to go. There is no such thing as perfect protest, and some protests, which was more effective than others. And I think a real theme of this entire series is you kind of watch me up close with some of these things. Some of these are situations that I'm a part of. Some I'm just as close as I can get, and you get a little glimpse as to what people are actually doing day to day with the movements that they're a part of. And I think there's hope to be found in that. I think we are a country full of fighters. We're a country full of resistors, people who want to push back, who want to remake the country into a better image the way in which they see it. And I think, like, that's not an easy thing to do, and you can't necessarily do it on your couch. And so I was moved by people on both sides of the aisle making this series, because there are people out there who are fighting, and they're not just talking, and they're not just bitching, and they're not just retweeting. They're fighting, and I think that spirit, hopefully that comes through.
Well, I really enjoyed what I've seen of the show, and I think folks are going to really like it. It makes you think. It makes you laugh. Before we go, I also want to point out that each episode is accompanied by a filmed podcast, too. Do you want to plug that as well?
I do. I mean, we've gone that extra step into a podcast where we're now filming it and putting it out. So we're essentially making television out of a podcast. So take that, America. Actually, we're really excited about it. If people are... If they enjoy the series and compelled by these stories, like each podcast is sort of a chance for us to talk about some of the things that happened off camera and also how some of these stories came together, the things that we couldn't include in the episodes, also the episodes that we think, like the things that we think worked, the things that we think could have worked better. I think like there's a lot of meaty topics and there's a lot to unpack and we only have 22 minutes to do it. And so we try to have a pretty frank conversation after each episode about like the process of trying to tell these stories in that small amount of time. So if you're curious about like how the sausage is made and also about how, whether the sausage is being made correctly, we kind of dive into that. And those pop up, right after every episode airs on Thursdays.
Good stuff. Well, Jordan Klepper's new series, Klepper, airs Thursdays on Comedy Central at 10:30 Eastern. Jordan, it's always fun to have you on. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Jordan Klepper for coming on the podcast. Klepper airs Thursdays at 10:30 Eastern on Comedy Central. For more information, visit ComedyCentral.com and follow Jordan on Twitter at Jordan Klepper. If you don't know SiriusXM, then listen up. Commercial-free music, plus sports, talk, comedy, and news, they have it all. And right now, you can get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for just $1. Go to SiriusXM.com/kick to see offer details and subscribe. That's Sirius, SiriusXM.com/kick. Offer available to new SiriusXM streaming subscribers. SiriusXM, no car required. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.